And welcome to Here We Stand. This is your regular host, Kevin Ann, Eagle Strong Voice. It's December 20th, The Ballad of the Carpenter. And yes, folks, things don't change over 2,000 years, do they? But you can sell out your brothers and sisters for a bit of money, as happens all the time in our movement. But crucifixions never solved anything, did it? It doesn't kill the spirit. We keep going. We're here every week, the voice of the Republic, republicofcanada.ca. Today's show is entitled Trash a Temple for Jesus and Other Christmas Reflections. I thought it appropriate that in this time of year we reflect a little bit about the things that have come before us that are actually helping us in our campaign to stop the COVID police state. Now, don't forget, and this is some ammunition that it continually baffles me why people not use the strength that we have and the weapons we have in this battle. Canada was declared a genocidal regime by law. Trudeau even admitted it in June of 2019. At that point, he and his entire government should have stood trial for war crimes in Canada. Instead, they bring in police state measures. Now, under international law, you cannot do that. Citizens are obligated not to obey the laws of their own government when they're committing genocidal crimes. Health Canada that's pushing the vaccinations, guilty of generations of slaughtering Indian children in experimental programs. So, folks, we have the basis to ignore all of this and say under international law, not only should we ignore COVID police state measures according to our September 8th common law passed, but we should be putting these people on trial. We should be arresting these people, forcing us to quarantine and mask and all this other nonsense. So that's the main point here. But why it has to do with the church? Well, first of all, the whole point of Christmas, this Christmas has nothing to do with Christianity. It was the Roman festival of Saturnalia. And December 25th, the slave owner would switch positions with the slave. He would serve his slave. They would pretend to be the master for a day. And it's interesting they use that date to suggest that that's when Jesus was born, because that's really very much the message of Jesus' revolutionary message, that the first are last and the last are first. And we've got a lot of experience of that. Now, this particular relevance of what you're going to hear today, we're talking about the evidence being used now in our church reclamation campaigns. Our groups across the country in league with Native people are planning church occupations. We are not only occupying, we're reclaiming the church buildings because the Catholic, Anglican, and United churches are criminally convicted bodies who have lost the right to their own property and assets. We have every lawful right to go in and seize them, take them over in the name of the Republic, open them up for the homeless, daycare centers, however we want to use them. Their wealth is forfeited, and we have every right to do that. So we have to understand what's responsible for that, why we're empowered to do that. So today we're going to be looking into some of the history of how these churches were found guilty by the International Common Law Court of Justice and the legal basis we have to do these things. So we're going to hear some really actually entertaining previous discussions we've had on this today, because don't forget the Roman Catholic Church was the model for the whole police state today. The corporatocracy over the centuries came out of Rome. And as Sun Tzu says, you cannot engage with an enemy without knowing them. You must know your enemy or you'll be defeated in the same way you need to know yourself. So we're going to go into that, including hearing today about some of the facts that haven't been revealed until now, 7 years after the conviction of Pope Benedict and Queen Elizabeth and the others who were forced to step down because of their involvement in ongoing crimes against humanity. We're going to hear about that today, how it came about specifically, the involvement of the Spanish government and various other people. And now this is really important for our defiance campaign today. And the final point, of course, is that as a convicted criminal regime, Canada has no right to impose any laws on anybody. They're not even laws, of course. These COVID police state measures are coming from a rogue power whose dictates we must, under law, not only defy, but turn back on them and put them on trial and shut down their system. That's the whole purpose of the Republic of Canada under a separate jurisdiction. Read more, republicofcanada.ca. So we're going to hear today on the show a lot of that good stuff. If you want to contact us, write to republicnationalcouncil@protonmail.com. And we have more to report in the coming weeks about the extent of our activity, how the Republic is growing by leaps and bounds, and so is the attacks. But that's to be expected when you're doing something right. So Enjoy the show today. Learn from it. Apply it, especially to the church reclamation campaigns. The last shall be first, folks. Stand strong. Stay clear. Here's the show.
And welcome to Here We Stand. I'm your regular host, Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice, and welcome back. That's good old Phil Oakes, the Ballad of the Carpenter. Phil Oakes, for in case you guys didn't know, was a wonderful man, a folk singer during the 60s, right at the heart of all of the great movements of liberation during that beautiful time. Died too young in 1975, possibly killed. But like Jesus himself, the spirit doesn't die, does it, folks? That song and this show is going out today to my father, Bill, and Eva and Wendy, south of the border, south of that imaginary border that pretends to divide us. And I wanted to start with a quote today from Abraham Lincoln at the start of the American Civil War, when he said, "In times like the present, men and women should utter nothing for which they would not willingly be responsible through time and eternity." And you could say that that's always been the theme on our show, my life. And by the way, today I'm on the verge of turning 64, believe it or not. And we're going to dedicate part of that show to that fact. At the end of the show, we're going to have a little reflection I did on that, on the whole thing of aging and life. Hope you enjoy it. But before that, I wanted to lay out some of what we're going to be talking about today. And for those of you on our mailing list, you already have this. If you want to get on our mailing list, write to thecommonland@gmail.com. A lot of the stuff you'll be hearing about today is, of course, online, documented for over 25 years at murderbydecree.com. And today's program has to do with another important anniversary. On February 11th, it's the 7th anniversary of the stepping down from office of people who even at Catholic cardinals used to call Joe the Rat, Joseph Ratzinger, former Pope Benedict, who's still hiding out in the Vatican 7 years later. Well, what's interesting today and of great relevance to upcoming events that we're going to be talking about is that there was a seven-year statute of limitation on some of the legal facts surrounding his forced resignation. Basically, that resignation happened because of the common law court case we convened, whose verdict came out in the same two-week period that he resigned in February 2013. And I'm going to share a little bit in a moment about the facts, the legal facts now that after 7 years can be shared about that. But in terms of the rest of the show, besides this discussion of the criminality of Ratzinger, what forced his resignation and what it has to do with our campaigns today to stop child-killing institutions like the Church of Rome, is we're going to be having a very important talk I gave that was never actually given. I was invited to speak at the Oxford Union, the oldest debating society in the world, at Oxford University in England, and of course they canceled it at the last moment. But the topic was, is there any good in the Roman Catholic Church? And I had quite a fun time giving that talk, so we're going to play that. And another reflection, like I said, about aging, what it's like now at age 64. Of course, my dad's 92, so I'm a spring chicken in comparison, but it is what it is. It's all a matter of mind and will and spirit, right, folks? And, of course, the closing song is really a fun one, too. It's called The Pope Song by Tim Minchin, and I know it'll rouse a lot of you one way or the other, but that's kind of a summary of the show today. Now, before we get on to the main body of it, I want to give you an update of how this information is relevant, because on March 16th and on March 30th, there's two very important events happening in Vancouver. One is a public hearing at which many of the things that I've encountered personally will be presented leading up to the March 30th Common Law Court. It's called the West Coast Common Law Court of Justice. It's looking into the ongoing crimes of genocide in Western Canada, involving all those same actors of church, state, corporations, but now involving the Chinese in a big way. So please stay tuned for the next two shows, February 16th and 23rd, leading up to those announcements. But in terms of what I mentioned earlier, 7 years ago, this Tuesday, Ratzinger resigns. He's the first pope in papal history in peacetime ever to resign. And of course, it was put down to the usual, excuse of health problems. Actually, what happens, 5 days before that, on February 6th, he had received a diplomatic note from the Spanish government saying he might face arrest if he come to Spain, based on the evidence that's seen in the docket of the court that we had put forward. And what was really interesting about that was that it was actually put forward by somebody whose name we can now release. The individual responsible was a man called Eduardo Gutierrez de Baruga, and he was the Spanish ambassador to the Vatican. He's the one who issued the diplomatic note, and then Ratzinger resigns 5 days later because we had solid evidence that he had not only signed letters to bishops around the world telling them to cover up child trafficking, not just child rape, but child trafficking and the institutionalized murder of children through the Catholic Church Ninth Circle Network, which a lot of you know about if you followed her work. But Ratzinger himself was involved and actually personally involved in those crimes, and Gutierrez de Baruga had that information in his hand. He basically forced Ratzinger to step down, along with a guy called Tarcisio Bertone, who was the Vatican Secretary of State. Now, Bertone had just got in hot water with Ratzinger because he had helped spill the beans on, just a few months previous to that, the Pope's butler, Paolo Gabriel, had been arrested by Vatican police because he had been sharing Vatican secrets, the Pope's personal diary, with reporters. In fact, it had been instigated by Bertone. Now, you say, why did the Secretary of State and the Spanish ambassador help force out Ratzinger? Well, it's because they were working hand in glove with Jorge Bergoglio, the present Pope, who's very much in line with the Agenda 2030 New World Order agenda of one corporation, one church, one world government, one world religion, that the old guard and the Italian kind of mafia cardinals around Ratzinger weren't totally on board with. So it is basically a palace coup initiated by the present Pope, who himself has his hands filled with a lot of blood from the Argentina military days, from his ties with the Ninth Circle in the Netherlands, and so on. So it's interesting how it all was really a result of, you know, that kind of palace coup. But the reason they had to keep Ratzinger on his side as well was because of another fellow. And again, we can now, after 7 years, go public about this. His name is Baltazar Garzon. He's a Spanish judge, a very famous man, if you look up his name, Garzon, G-A-R-Z-O-N. And he was involved in the extraditing to Spain of General Pinochet to stand trial in 1998. He brought charges against the Franco government officials for atrocities during the Franco dictatorship. He found mass graves of children at former Catholic schools. He indicted five members of the Bush administration for torture. So the guy was quite out front. Well, guess what? We had asked him to chair our common law court trial, the one that started in 2012, 2 months before he was to start that and take out formal leadership within our tribunal, the ITCCS, that was formed in June 2010. Well, guess what? In May 2010, Garzon is suddenly blocked from a judgeship. There's charges brought against him by the Spanish government, which in fact was the Vatican behind the scenes, and they forced Baltazar Garzon out of his judgeship. He's still suspended from practicing law because of the blowback from his, you know, willingness to take on all these genocidal institutions. But Baltazar Garzon has been one of the judges providing us with a lot of good legal help, and in fact he's the chief legal advisor to Julian Assange as well. So Garzon and others around him have been providing our tribunal and the common law court a lot of expertise and information, which is one of the reasons we've been able to force Ratzinger and others out of office. As a matter of fact, when Ratzinger stepped down, so did Tarcisio Bertone, the Secretary of State, because they had to conceal the connection to the incoming Pope, who was basically appointed, Jorge Bergoglio. Smiley face Francis, that was brought in to do the spin operation for the Vatican. But also we forced out Cardinal Sean Brady of Ireland and the head of the Jesuits, the so-called Black Pope, Adolfo Pichon. All four of those guys had been mentioned, named in the indictment against the Vatican and other actors in the first common law court case that was brought by the common law court in Brussels. Now, you can look at the documents of that online, murderbydecree.com. Go to, on that site, ITCCS Archives, go to links, and then you'll see one that says the International Common Law Court of Justice, case number one, genocide in Canada. That's the one that forced Ratzinger from office. That's a lot of the information you need. So that's kind of a background and a sharing of information that we haven't been able to up till now in the last 7 years, but now legally we can do it. And a final, before we get into this next phase of what we're doing on the show, a question to all of you. Now that these churches have been convicted, we know they've mass murdered children over the generations. In Canada alone, over 60,000 Indigenous children. Trudeau himself, the Prime Minister, is now saying, yes, it was genocide, kind of ignoring the fact that, therefore, Canada must now be prosecuted and punished under international law for admitting genocide. Why is it that none of these churches have been brought to trial? Why are they allowed to continue to legally operate? Why do people keep putting money in collection plates? Why aren't there hundreds of protesters out in front of these churches demanding that these child killers be stopped? Because the crime isn't yesterday, it's ongoing as we speak. Well, that's a question we're going to talk about in the future. We've talked about it before, but it has to do with the extent to which all of us are conditioned not to raise our thoughts or our hands against these governing bodies. We're all complicit because of the way we've been conditioned, and we need to overcome that personal conditioning and complicity if these crimes are ever to be stopped. So that's another aspect of what we're doing, reclaiming our minds so that we can reclaim our children and our world. You can't have one with the other. There's no point, folks, taking on activism if you haven't begun to free your own complicity and your own mental cooperation and spiritual connection to these crimes. So that's a whole aspect of what we do, and we'll be going into more of that. Now, what I want to do next is introduce this next piece, which, again, is a very important talk I gave. Actually never gave, but I put it online after to show the world, hey, this is what I was going to speak about at the Oxford Union, folks. The topic is there any good in the Roman Catholic Church? And I was to debate a Vatican official in 2016 about that, but the offer was withdrawn, of course, as it always is, at the last minute. But this has got a lot of important information and stuff you can share with people in the whole argument of why these churches need to be legally and politically and morally disestablished for their crimes of the past, present, and future if we don't stop them. So we're going to hear that talk. And after that, we're going to get a bit lighter. I'm going to then give a little thing, a reflection called The Importance of Doing Nothing. And that's kind of a reflection I gave, realizing the other day that, geez, I'm 64 now, folks. I started this campaign when I was 38. And I hope you enjoy it. I hope you enjoy both. And, of course, the final song at the end. So until next week, stay strong, stay clear. Listen, learn, take action. Thanks, folks.
Good evening. I'm Kevin Annett. And tonight I'm going to give you a lecture that I was to present to the Oxford Union, which is the oldest debating society in the world. In April 2016, I was invited to come there in Oxford University in England and debate a cleric of the Catholic Church over the issue. Funnily enough, the topic was, is there any good in the Roman Catholic Church? Well, as so often happens on these occasions, the invitation to me was unexplainably withdrawn about 2 weeks before the event, and the debate between me and him never happened. So I thought it would be good to post online for the world to see exactly what I was going to say that night. Good evening. Let me begin by saying what a pleasant surprise it is to be able to join you all here tonight. The last time I tried to give a public talk in England, at a London rally to protest child trafficking by church and state, your privately run UK border agency saw fit to arrest, fingerprint, jail me, and then finally deport me from your country without giving a reason at all. So be that as it may, and it usually is, I especially want to thank you for having me here tonight, having the courage to have me here tonight. Tonight's topic for debate is framed rather tellingly. Is there any good in the Roman Catholic Church? And assumably by that is meant its holding company, the Vatican Incorporated. Well, the very wording of the subject's interesting because it implies that, no, there isn't any good at all. Let's search for some. Of course, trying to locate integrity in a corporation is like looking for love in a brothel. So perhaps the question of tonight's debate's already been answered. My job's done. We can all go home. In any event, the title of the main event tonight is a bit confusing, beginning with the term good, which is, after all, a completely relative and morally ambiguous term. The Spanish conquistadors and their slaughter-blessing Catholic priests thought that they were doing good when they wiped out millions of non-Catholic people for their own good. The Vatican's Inquisition that barbecued and tortured to death Christians who disagreed with Rome was officially entitled an auto da fe, which means act of faith. Even the present so-called liberal Pope Francis, Jorge Bergoglio, speaks of the goodness and zeal of the Franciscan missionaries who worked to death thousands of Aboriginal men, women, and children on Catholic slave plantations in California. Well, some things never change. Bergoglio also recently pardoned some 10,000 of his own child-raping priests, no doubt in the same spirit of doing good, at least good for his own institution. Human beings, especially when goaded on and justified by religion, always adorn their crimes in a halo of goodness. I've had personal experience of what I speak about. For over 20 years in Canada, I've lived and worked and documented alongside these folks who have lived through this story, the reality of genocide in Canada, perpetrated mostly by Catholic-run Indian residential schools, where over 60,000 children died. Half of these children never came back because at the hands of the priests and nuns, they were ritually tortured, routinely starved, trafficked, experimented upon, flogged, gang-raped, and killed en masse with smallpox and tuberculosis. Not one Catholic priest has ever gone to trial for any of these crimes, nor will they. These killers are above the law as it stands now. And having had the misfortune of speaking with enough of these scum, I know that these complicit clergy are still convinced that they were only trying to do good to the little brown savages by killing their bodies to save their souls, to quote their buddy Thomas Aquinas, one of the founding theologians of the Catholic Church. So perhaps what we need to do is redefine the term good in a better way, using this simple definition. To do good means to do no harm to others and to let them be themselves. Of course, under that definition, you immediately disqualify and condemn the Roman Catholic Church, which has killed more people than any institution in human history. The Church of Rome's body count is well over 50 million corpses, ever since it was made a legal corporation by the Emperor Constantine in the year 317. All right, that may all be true, sputter the defenders of Rome. So nobody's perfect. But look at all the charitable works the Church does all the time. Isn't that good? Well, in that sense, perhaps tonight's topic for debate should have been entitled instead, Was There Any Good in Pablo Escobar, the head of the criminal syndicate known as the Medellin Drug Cartel? Because Pablo engaged in lots of charitable good works for the poor folks of Colombia. Just like the Roman Catholic Church, of which he was a dues-paying member, Pablo used his ill-gotten loot to build shelters for the homeless, playgrounds for some slum kids, and soup kitchens for the hungry. Of course, that charitable money was covered in blood and paid for by the early deaths from drug addiction of the very same people he was helping, but still, he was doing some good, wasn't he? Now, my analogy between Pablo Escobar and the Vatican is more than fitting, since not only are they members of the same club, but also the Vatican Bank is heavily invested in the international drug cartels, as well as the arms and human trafficking industries that go along with it. GMO companies, Big Pharma, the biggest small arms company in the world, Beretta Limited, even dozens of online internet porn companies, all of these 100% Vatican investments pay for the goodies doled out to those deserving poor people who kiss the claw that feeds them. But let's take on directly the suggestion that the Roman Catholic Church, as the world's richest and least accountable corporation, plays a major role in providing charitable sustenance to the world's needy. Let's ask, what percentage of the Church's annual revenue actually goes towards charitable works? Well, it's an important question, not only for the debate tonight, but because the only legal basis for the Church to be exempt from paying taxes under the Law of Nations is that they must devote all, not some, but all, of their collected revenue for either the advancement of religion or charitable works. Well, right there, you can knock out the Roman Catholic Church unless someone wants to explain what money laundering for the mafia, buying cruise missiles for third world dictators, or issuing routine bribes to politicians and governments all over the world have to do with either religion or charity. What percentage of the Catholic Church's revenue goes towards charity? Actually, less than 1%, at least in America. For tellingly, that's the only country in the world where the Church consistently publishes any of its financial records. After all, the Vatican is a closed, self-governing, totally unaccountable body, like any secret criminal society. But that inconvenient, lingering notion of a separation of church and state found in the American Constitution requires that even the Catholic Church has to create an appearance of transparency. And so according to the U.S. government, in the year 2013, the Roman Catholic Church in America had a net revenue of $13.4 billion. And that's just in one country, where only about 15% of the world's Catholics live. Per projection, the annual income of the Vatican must be in the hundreds of billions of dollars, not just from all those collection plates from those saps, but also from its massive global investment portfolio and its secret financial concordat agreements with over 100 governments that channel a regular percentage of your tax money into the Vatican Bank and all of its criminal behavior. But coming back to America, the one country where a light is shone on the murky underworld of Vatican finances, according to the same self-audit of the Catholic Church, of the $13.4 billion raked in during 2013, only 1.1% of it went to charity. But since half of that amount came from government grants to Catholic aid societies, in reality, a whopping 0.6% of the income went from the bank accounts into charities. But since those charities are mostly owned and operated by the church itself, it just means that one hand of the octopus is feeding the other. Quite brilliant, don't you think? One half of 1%, friends. The truth is that the Roman Catholic Church is not a force for charitable works. Just look at the books. It's in fact a huge criminal racket, a money-sucking corporation that kept afloat by every taxpayer in the world. Okay, so let's turn to the other basis for the church not paying a dime of taxes, the advancement of religion. What percentage of its time and money goes towards advancing its particular, and I might say extremely violent, religious creed? Less than 10%. That's the time each week a priest spends conducting prayers, masses, or catechism classes, according to the church itself, according to a statement from the Vatican's Governing College of Cardinals, who in 2014 issued an internal report concerning the training and ordination of its priests. The main job of the clergy, according to the cardinals, is the material and social upkeep of the church, guarding the building, the safeguard of its traditions and operations, and the expansion of its income and membership. Like in any big corporation, somebody somewhere tell me where God, let alone Jesus Christ, enters into that whole mess. Okay, strike two. In case you didn't know, that's a baseball term. I don't play cricket. The third and final strike against the Roman Catholic Church, and you got to watch out that for that term because the word Catholic means universal, which it is not. The final strike against the Catholic Church lies in its real and not imagined nature. Once its enormous pretense and lie is pulled back and we see it for what it is historically and today. But to do so and to pierce the mental fog surrounding the Vatican Incorporated, we have to realize that the papacy is not a Christian church at all. On the contrary, it is in every respect a cult of emperor worship derived from late 3rd century Rome, not from the historic Jesus, not even from the early Christian church. This fact is crucial if we're to deal with the mental confusion of many people, atheists included, who ponder helplessly, but how can a body that preaches about the love of Jesus cause mass murder, genocide, and institutionalized child rape? Of course, the simple answer to that is that it's always the worst child rapist in town who has the most sterling reputation. The latter is needed as a cloak by any crook. The bigger the felony, the sweeter the coating. Talk, my friends, is easy, especially from a pulpit. But let's not forget what Jesus himself warned, quote, many false prophets will come in my name and say, I am the Christ. But do not be fooled. By their works, you shall know them. Bingo. By their works, you shall know them. Well, we can see the works of the papacy all too well. Conquest, brutality, just wars, genocide, inquisition, and the crushing of the human spirit. And it all began when the Roman emperors Aurelian and Constantine created the Roman Catholic Church on the murdered bones of the early Christian church. The church was an extension and continuation of that other big killing machine called the Roman Empire. Proof of this, you don't have to look any further than the Pope's official title, which is Pontifex Maximus, which in Latin means the great bridge between, guess where, heaven and earth. That was the Latin title of the emperors of Rome, starting with Aurelian in the year 275, who also assumed the title Deus et Dominus, means God and Master. One man who's become God. Well, first that was the emperor, but now today to a Catholic, it's the Pope. Christ is no longer the link to God, but a man is, elected and elevated blasphemously over humanity, even over God, by other old men in funny hats. Well, not surprisingly, every newly elected Pope is also given the title Vicari Christi, which is even more blatant. In Latin, it means the replacement of Christ, the one who replaces Christ. In black and white, it's right there. Catholicism, papism, is the replacement of Christianity. An empire of conquest and wealth relying on the means of the world and not the way of Christ. Just look at the body count. And listen to these admissions of guilt right from the horse's mouth, or I should say ass. Statements from various popes down the centuries that have never been contradicted or repudiated by any of their successors. Pope Boniface in 1302. We declare it is necessary for every human creature to be subject to the Roman pontiff. Pope Leo in 1520. The Pope is Christ himself on earth. Pope Pius in 1929. Fascism is simply the doctrines of our faith made the law in government. Pope John in 1962. No man may enter into Christ unless he be led there by the sovereign pontiff. Pope John Paul in 1996. Have no fear when men call me Christ on earth, for I am he. Pope Benedict in 2008. You need not go to Christ for salvation. Come to me. Pope Francis in 2016. Christ made himself sin, made himself the devil. That's new. For our salvation. Only the church and its magisterium can claim holy infallibility. Have you had enough? I know I have. Well, is it any wonder that such a power-obsessed, megalomaniac religion makes itself unaccountable, sees nothing with its crimes, and uses the image and words of Christ himself to delude and soak its millions of dupe followers to believe that a bit of a communion wafer or a papal blessing or the right amount of cash delivered into church coffers will buy their way into heaven, as if one can? Well, unfortunately, I saw it for myself when I was last in Rome in 2011. Right there in the Vatican Museum, a display board for buying indulgences just like out of Martin Luther's day. Special papal blessings cost you only 150 euros. The more you spend, the closer you get to heaven. Although be warned, apparently, according to the sign, apparently God prefers credit cards to cash. How right when Pope Leo in 1520 said, "This myth of Christ has served us well." Well, the most dangerous group in the world is a super wealthy cult that sees itself as God, superior to everyone, and therefore justified in doing whatever is needed to protect itself and rule the world. A cult, in other words, like the Church of Rome. What other being than a cult can operate according to a criminal policy like Crimen Solicitanus, which has been binding on all Catholics since the year 1929? That policy states that whenever a child is raped or otherwise harmed by a priest, the police are not to be told, the victim is to be silenced, and if anyone speaks of this, they are excommunicated, thrown into hell for snitching on a rapist. Clearly, the God of Rome, like the Mafia, cannot tolerate a snitch. Better instead to operate under a global criminal conspiracy to aid and abet child rapists and killers than to cost the church a lawsuit or save a child's life. Heaven forbid. And yet, despite all of this criminal arrangement, the world keeps wondering why there's so much child rape within the Church of Rome. Are we all that blind? Do we really think a lion isn't going to eat a gazelle? Well, John Acton, a British politician, said, "Absolute power corrupts absolutely." He was referring to the Church of Rome when he made that statement, something conveniently left out of the history books. The Church of Rome is absolutely corrupt, but it also corrupts whoever is near to it, like all who attend it, who fund it, who associate with it, or rent its halls, or smile on its policies, or look the other way at all its public relations gestures. All who do so partake in that corruption. And under the law of God and mankind, those human accessories are equally guilty of all its crimes. The only good that can be said to come out of this most violent, corrupt, and anti-Christ body in history is how its evil awakens people to the need for a return to the simple words, witness, and spirit of Jesus himself, a spirit that has always been the chief adversary of the Church of Rome. Jesus founded a community of called out people, a remnant not of this world, a congregation, not a church. Nowhere did Jesus speak of popes, of bishops, of rituals and ceremonies by which someone would mediate him and God to others. He said that the kingdom of heaven lay inside each of us, not outside in a communion wafer or a religious ritual. That inner kingdom of Christ alone is the guide of all true Christians, who must come out from and be separate from all these vile, false and violent churches that deny God in practice and kill children in practice. And that's the task of any deluded soul still caught in the fatal grip of Rome and its blasphemous illusions and depravities. As America's founding fathers said, we hold this truth to be self-evident. And one of those men, the second U.S. president, John Adams, said, quote, "A free government and the Roman Catholic religion can never exist together in any nation or country. Liberty and popery are opposed," unquote. The nature of an ancient corporate evil like the Church of Rome does not change over time. It simply alters its appearance because it comes out of the dark ruler of this world, the one whom Jesus said, "He is a lie from the beginning, for he is the father of lies," Satan. It's a good thing to free ourselves from a lie as huge as Roman Catholicism and as criminal. As free-born men and women, we are made for the truth, and when we recognize it, our hearts and our minds breathe freely and we return to our natural sense of liberty and independence. From that place of freedom, we are empowered to take action to stop criminals in every high place, whether they be popes or presidents or prime ministers. For we, the people, are the source of all sovereignty, of government, of law, and of religion. We can and must stop and arrest and confine child-raping priests when the police and courts refuse to do so. We can and must shut down the churches that traffic children and have hidden their crimes over centuries, like the Catholic Church, the Anglican Church of England, the United Church of Canada, all of these criminal bodies. For the life of one child is more sacred than all the fanfare and rituals of any church anywhere. Well, Jesus had his own prescription for child killers. He said, "Whoever would harm one of these innocent ones should have a millstone placed around his neck and be thrown into the sea." Well, I wonder what Jesus would say about an entire institution that mocks God, murders with impunity, rapes and murders children, and protects those who do so. Is there a millstone that is big enough to sink such an institution? Yes, there is. It is we, the people. I thank you. Hi, everyone. It's Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice, and I'm back with a, I think, humorous reflection called The Importance of Doing Nothing. I start with a quote from my good buddy Marcus Aurelius in his Meditations. All we have is the present moment, and that is all we ever lose. Well, my usual urge to grasp the day or my member was strangely absent when I awoke this morning. It might have been the weather. The forecast week of constant rain had inexplicably given way to a splendid clear sky. As I basked in the sunlight that crept along my covers, the dulcet refrain of birdsong sounded through my window like a blissful siren, coaxing me to drop anchor and listen. It was a familiar trail, evoking childhood memories of prairie wrens strafing me like Messerschmitts. The little bird was persistent. Once I rolled over and he could see that I was stirring, he stopped chirping and buggered off. I tried sitting up, but leaving the sumptuous warmth of my bed was just not on, so I fell back against the pillows and imagined a certain someone serving me breakfast in bed. Well, the fact that she was many, many miles away made the thought even more delicious. After all, hadn't Mr. Spock observed once in the Star Trek episode when another Vulcan had wooed away his sweetheart T'Pring? Quote, "It is oddly true that having is not nearly as satisfying as wanting." That got me wondering on two counts why it was that my adolescent plan to reach the far edge of our galaxy as part of the world's first interstellar sleeper ship mission, or even a journey to the moon for that matter, had never come off. I'd like to blame grade 10 math. My crash-and-burn performance with algebra and calculus that year scuttled forever any thought of me joining the space program or mastering astrophysics. Like a hopeful amputee thinking he can race the 100 meters, I toyed after that with the option of being the first journalist ever to travel to the rings of Saturn. It's pure bullshit in hindsight, but I still look upward at night. A full hour floated by like that as I mused about Alpha Centauri and my brief moment here in the cosmos. And then I heard a scratching on the window screen, and guess what? My little avian body was back, twittering and exhorting me, it seemed, to get my ass out of bed. "What do you want from me?" I said aloud in my best Joe Pesci imitation. "Who are you, my mother?" Well, the latter was generally not a happy camper, except when she was telling one of us what to do. At 7:30 every morning, Mum's voice would sound over the intercom speaker that she'd craftily set up in the otherwise secluded part of the house, occupied by my brother Bill and I. "Up and at 'em, boys," Mum would announce with a contrived cheerfulness. Just 40 minutes to get out the door. Fuck you, Bill would occasionally mutter, but never to her face, of course. Well, that shocked me at the time, but what bothers me more now, and upon which I pondered while prone in bed this morning, was why the hell neither of us simply unplugged the goddamn intercom. Well, I credit that pubescent experience for my normative pangs of guilt when I don't bound out of bed each morning. But today, the ghost of Mummy Dearest had flown off with my feather tormentor, and damn, it felt good. In that puff of elation, I lay in bed on principle for another half hour until my hips started aching. They do that more often these days, thanks to disintegrating bursts in my joint or something like that. I doubt if such a malady would have been mine if I had have achieved my dream of a weightless existence somewhere between here and the Crab Nebula. But there you have it. The nearly empty refrigerator that greeted me gave me the excuse I needed to sojourn to the corner store and, to my real destination, the nearby post office and the posh mail lady with whom I'm secretly in love. But all that had to wait on me making myself presentable, at least to a 30-something babe. Well, my prospects didn't seem that great when I saw what stared back at me from the bathroom mirror. The first 21,000 days do take their toll. Doubting that a shave would improve the appeal of my frayed visage to even the most desperate woman, I didn't bother. That left only breakfast, but like I said, there was nothing to eat in the fridge, and since trotting my path to the store without gazing upon the object of my desire was too bitter a course to contemplate, I chose hunger. Le coeur a ses raisons, n'est-ce pas? Going hungry, for love or for food, is not something exactly foreign to me. During my lean 20s, or while living out of my car in the worst of my post-defrocking years, or recently, I've learned the art of filling my stomach with enough water to simulate satiation from a full-course meal. It's actually pretty easy to do. I found it easier to fake the feeling the older I get. My dad, who turns 91 soon, tells me that he rarely eats much nowadays because, quote, it's like fucking. A nice idea, but there's just no there anymore. Well, speaking of nothingness, one of my fellow seminarians was an especially obnoxious Anglican named Ian Garshore. Ian used to go on and on about his plan to take a vow of poverty. He never actually did it, of course, at least during the years I knew him, but he liked the idea. I once told him that only rich folks think like that, but he didn't seem to hear me. Well, sitting there on my couch this morning, famished, ill-clad, and ill-kempt, and recalling Ian's smug demeanor, I suddenly had the urge to dig out my leaflets. But then I realized that it would be only me handing them out at the local churches. Besides, it wasn't even a Sunday, and the last people who are able to read and understand that they're full of shit are church people. But darkness is relative. The sunlight kept pouring through the window, and since high noon was approaching by then, I felt compelled to get dressed. It was the first real compulsion I had today, and besides my brief flush of lechery, and that impulse to start doing something felt strange, like a stream's natural flow is being artificially channeled into some concrete byway by something other than me. So instead I threw on a robe and let the current take me out onto the porch and deposit me onto a worn sofa, the one that looks out over the backyard in its overgrown jungle. Well, just then, Dum-Dum appeared. He froze in his tracks and regarded me with a half-stupefied look you don't normally associate with a stray cat. Dum-Dum's an odd one. He won his name from his tendency to barrel into our house and race around in a confused manner, all the time uttering a plaintive cry. But today he just sat in the grass and kept staring blankly at me, the way my parishioners used to do whenever I preached. I tossed a rock into the grass to see what he'd do, but he just stared at the object with the same blank expression. You're a real Dum-Dum, I said on cue. Half-wits notwithstanding, cats normally move the way people should, the way I've learned to operate, especially in certain neighborhoods. It's a delight to watch felines creep deliberately through any terrain, wholly attentive, alert to any slight movement, the completely focused hunter. Homo sapiens move, contrarily, like game waiting to be pounced upon, especially nowadays when compact Medusa screens absorb the oblivious gaze of people on a treadmill to disaster. Cats, on the other hand, are never taken by surprise. The phone rang just then. An unfamiliar female voice spoke into the answering machine.
Hi, I'm looking for Reverend Annett, if this is the right number. I've been following his work for a long time, and I'm a big fan of his, and so I was wondering if you could tell me whether this is the end times or not. I think I've been contacted by the Pleiadians. Okay. Well, glancing at the yard and noticing his sudden absence, I wondered for a moment whether Dum-Dum had miraculously acquired the power of speech and manual dexterity and was calling me from the nearby payphone. Oddly enough, the phone call got me hankering for some human contact. My hopes soaring with thoughts of the post office, I not only dressed, but even took the time to shave finally. But alas, a 15-minute hike brought my plans to naught. Philatelic babe was nowhere in sight. The guy behind the counter started eyeing me as I hung around the envelope shelf. I couldn't bring myself to ask whether she was working today. Hell, I still don't even know her name. Can I help you with something, sir? I get referred to with that title a lot these days. It's one of the perks of visibly sagging. I don't seem to be a threat to anyone. Being aged cuts both ways, of course. The upside is, young women smile at me more and don't realize that I'm actually a dirty old man. Downside, I'm invisible. Sure enough, the postal clerk accepted my paltry explanation for my loitering with intent, namely that I was just thinking. He paid me no mind after that and didn't even notice my probing glances into the back room for you-know-who. Well, Byron said that even love must rest. I let my paramour recede into the land of mists. The day remained sunny, nevertheless. I soon joined all the other old farts who make their daily progress around the Seashore Park promenade, thinking that they're walking years off their frame. Reminded me of the former landlady of mine who took to renting out her place after her 36-year-old husband dropped dead from a brain aneurysm. Gone before he hit the ground, poof. The guy was a health nut and in top shape, ironically. I thought of him as I strolled along the path and felt tempted to halt the next group of octogenarian joggers I encountered and tell them that all their efforts won't make a single bloody difference. The fuse has been lit in each one of us, and no one knows when we'll ignite. But I keep getting told that people do need their hopes. Well, my Uncle Lloyd has the final word on death and the odds. It took the guy years to finally kick after the doctors routinely warned him that he was a goner if he ate one more piece of apple pie, or any kind of pie for that matter. With that sentence hanging over his head, he had often scarfed down an entire chocolate cake with the same overjoyed expression. Lloyd was the original Epicurean. He really didn't give a shit about when the axe descended on him. Maybe having been nearly shot execution style by the Hitler Youth at Normandy Beach, and subsequently starving on beetroots in a German prisoner of war camp, it's something to do with his stoic indifference to the Grim Reaper. Lloyd had a serious diabetic problem from his prison time and from being raised in deep poverty as a kid in North Winnipeg. But that condition never stood in the way of his diving into a third helping at the Bonanza Restaurant smorgasbord, where he'd gleefully take me and his other nephews. I used to watch in awe as he routinely chowed down on a mountain of steak, pizza, hors d'oeuvres and desserts that could have sunk a freighter. He did Thoreau proud, sucking the marrow out of life. Lloyd and my own father come from a generation of people who were not overly concerned at all about their fragile mortality. Eat, drink, and be merry, for today we may die. They were grateful to still be alive after the Depression and the war, and took nothing for granted. War vets from that era recovered a hell of a lot better than the Vietnam generation. They had a humbly realistic view of life and harbored none of the narcissistic self-obsession of folks nowadays. Maybe that's why I liked my elders so much growing up. Well, musing thus and feeling my own seventh decade, I sat on a bench for some time, gazing out on the waves and the meandering seagulls and the slowly approaching Horseshoe Bay Ferry, filled with lots of busy and worried people in a big hurry to get nowhere, to quote Orville Renwick. Orville is a wheat farmer near Malinta, Manitoba. He gets the jitters whenever he visits a big place like Souris, Manitoba, population 1,876. The land and the sky and his family are enough for Orville. He's a contented man, and I envy him. Well, thinking of Orville and his equally happy brood, who used to lay some fantastic meals on me whenever I was at their place as their minister, I felt even more rooted to my perch there on the seashore. There is, after all, no such domestic joy nest awaiting me, Nothing and no one to go home to, and so one spot is as good as another. Upside, the entire world is my home as a consequence, and I own everything and everyone. Downside, having it all means you have nothing and no one, really. Because for me, love must be as specific as one woman's soft and accepting touch. A long time ago, I wrote in my journal that I had no home in this world, that my only security resided in a future just society. That promised land is as far away as ever these days, but the search and the struggle for it has made the void recede a bit. Is that assurance my equivalent of worldly happiness? It'll have to do. My descent on the slippery mortal slope is quickening nowadays, like the roller coaster ride at the PNE. The wind rose suddenly and a salt spray gently bathed my face the way a mother should. Dusk was falling. My usual urgency had subsided the way the day was doing, leaving a raw I am. Curiously, the velvet night seemed all at once like the Japanese garden on the UBC campus, which I'd first explored as a teenager, laid out to symbolize an entire human life. After all the twisting and turning paths, here I was, in the quiet bamboo hut that looks back over the panorama of the entire garden. With stillness has come an understanding gained over the long journey. Once in my endless searching through the foliage, standing still would have seemed impossible. But now, I realized I had come to that inner land where even contentment lay, and that welcomed me in. But of course it was not enough. Joe Hensby was right. The battered old communist longshoreman gave me the straight goods early on in my life as we mused together over beers in the Lotus Hotel. So what's it all for? I asked him with my 17-year-old credulity, after listening to his raw monologue of being shot at and beaten to a pulp by Mounties and mob goons during unwinnable strikes. What, life? He belched. Well, yeah. He squinted at me like I was Ronnie the retard who begged for change outside the pub in return for the chance to recite his latest poem about his abduction by nubile female aliens. I mean, shit, Joe. You've had a completely fucked up life. Blacklisted, no work, an ulcer, 2 ruined marriages. Yeah, so? He barked. What do you expect? I'm a goddamn radical. Now, I was the one who looked confused. But Joe was nothing if not patient. He took a final swig of his beer and patted my arm. You make a choice, he said. Like when I got offered a supervisor job if I quit the union. You decide whether you want in or whether you want out. Everything else follows. I was contemplating all that when he belched again and retorted, But Christ, don't trust me, Kev. Don't ever trust anything you hear sitting in the fucking chair. I doubt if I'd ever have met Joe Hensby or all the ones like him who have helped me make the choice. If I'd have been on some cushy career fast track somewhere, sitting in a chair. I thought long and late on that defining fact of my life until sleep beckoned me to what passes as home. So here I am again, broke, besieged, alone, and sometimes down for the count, but never completely done. But hell, what do you expect, people? I'm a goddamn radical. This is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice, murderbydecree.com. Carry it on.